From historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, this is The Seminary Explores. Conversations about people, politics, theology, and life with your host, Dr. Nelson Strobert.
Welcome to The Seminary Explores. My name is Nelson Strobert, and today my guest is Dr. Charles Brown, Distinguished Professor of Ethics at Payne Theological Seminary in Wilberforce, Ohio. Welcome to The Seminary Explores.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Well, you're here in Gettysburg, and I really appreciate your taking time after an intensive week of teaching during our January term. And your course was on the work and life and theology of Dr. Martin Luther King. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
The course was specifically entitled The Theology and Ethics. The Theology and Ethics of Martin Luther King, Jr.
Okay.
And I taught it in order to first get students to study seriously the life and thought of Martin Luther King, Jr., focusing on his contribution to Christian theology and ethics through his leadership role in the civil rights movement from December 6, 1955, through April 4, 1968. December 6, 1955
yes.
was the first day the inaugural address for the Montgomery Improvement Association, and April 4th, 1968 was the date of his assassination.
Right. And when you talk about the Improvement Association, you're talking about the beginning of the Montgomery. Would that be the beginning of the Montgomery?
The beginning of the Montgomery protest.
Protest.
Yes.
Oh, okay. When you think about this intensive work that these students did, they had to do a lot of reading, correct?
They had to do a lot of reading. I wanted them to deal with Martin Luther King Jr. as a thinker as well as an activist. Most of them had some idea of Martin Luther King Jr. as an activist,
right,
and had some snippets of things regarding his ideas, especially I Have a Dream. But beyond that, they were basically not exposed to who Martin Luther King was from a holistic viewpoint or even the relationship between his activism and his thought.
Okay.
And I wanted them to be able to make that connection, because by understanding that he was a pastor, that he was that he was theologically trained, that he began this work as pastor of a church, and he continued it as a co-pastor of a church, of his home church, through his father's
right at Ebenezer, yeah,
and then you know, continued through, and from that time, I mean, throughout, mm-hmm. he had a pastoral relationship at Dexter Avenue, and then at Ebenezer.
Yeah, and this says something about as we look at leadership or pastoral leadership or.
Yes.
Or professional leadership in the church as pastor or deacon, deaconess, diaconal minister. It says that that our theological education prepares us for this activism and for working outside of the four walls of the church.
Exactly,
and that's what I hear from what you said.
Yes, and I wanted them to understand how the action that in which he was engaged was not haphazard,
right,
and was not merely motivated by tactics from a political strategic viewpoint,
mm-hmm.
but was actually undergirded by serious theological and ethical thought. And to do this, they had to do a lot of reading. They had to do basic reading in King's own writing.
Okay.
One of the sources they used was Claiborne Carson's edited work on the autobiography of Martin Luther King Jr., which is a collection of writings whereby Martin Luther King Jr. describes his life journey. He never wrote an autobiography on his own.
Exactly.
But since he had a habit of writing autobiographically, one could, by making a selection of various writings, develop a fairly coherent picture
exactly.
of his autobiography.
Right, and Claiborne Carson, his work is unique because he is authorized by the King family to do this type of... He has access to the papers by the family.
Exactly, yes. And he has access to the family for any corroboration that he needs and that kind of thing. So that was one of their key sources. Another one of their key sources was A Testament of Hope, is a collection of the key speeches, addresses, sermons, and books, a digest of the books written by Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that was edited by James M. Washington, which still remains, in a comprehensive way, the fundamental available published collection under one volume.
Exactly.
And then they also read a couple of books by Rufus Burrow Jr. One is his work God and Human Dignity is the title, God and Human Dignity, in which Rufus Burrow provides an introduction to the a formal way, a systematic way of understanding Martin Luther King's theology and his ethics, his moral thought, as it relates to the tradition of training that he received at Boston University and the tradition of Boston personalism.
Oh, okay.
So that's the authoritative work on Martin Luther King Jr. as a systematic thinker.
Mm-hmm.
He also has done a book available for lay people entitled Martin Luther King Jr. for Armchair Theologians.
Okay.
And they also read that book because that book provided, we use that book as to provide an overview. As an introduction. So that's something they could read and get an overview, and yet it would relate to what we were actually going to pursue and study.
Okay.
But in addition to the reading, I also wanted them to experience the civil rights movement in a visual and audio way so that they would understand that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s thought was framed within the context of an ongoing historical movement it was in the process of living through and taking the background that he brought to the situation and working it out under the actual circumstances of the struggles for civil rights. And in order to experience that, since very few of the students had lived it in any way.
That's right.
I used the videos primarily from Eyes on the Prize.
Right, yes.
Because so that to try to give them that live frame of reference. And I also wanted them to hear Dr. King's voice.
Right.
Because reading, simply reading the text, is not as helpful and effective a way as being able to hear his voice. That they needed to hear his voice as they did the reading.
Right, and to hear that voice in the context of the struggles and issues that he was dealing with.
Exactly.
It sounds like an exciting time for students.
Well, it's an exciting time for me as well, because I've been doing this for a long time.
Well, that brings me to my next question. How is it that you came to immerse yourself or to look at King in this scholarly way?
Well, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated April 4th, 1968. In September of 1968, I began my first teaching assignment as an assistant professor of church and society at United Theological Seminary in Dayton.
Oh, okay.
And in the process of that teaching, it quickly became a question. What are the varieties of ways that black experience contributes to theological education? And I noticed that some of my colleagues were teaching courses on Schleiermacher,
right,
on Barth, on Tillich.
Right, the giants in a classical theological education.
Yes. And so I proposed that I wanted to do a course on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as both and from the standpoint of theology and ethics, because that was the nature of his contribution. At the
right.
time, you know, I that was all I had going at the time.
Right.
And so I taught the first course in the spring of 1970.
Okay.
And I have been teaching a version of this course off and on, either as a full-time seminary professor mm-hmm. or as an adjunct professor at United Seminary and at Payne Theological Seminary, where I currently teach, and more recently as an exchange professor here at Lutheran since 1970, which is a total of a period of 44 years now that I have been trying to do this course.
So you bring your own history to this course as well.
Yes, because I did experience the work of Martin Luther King Jr., the leadership of Martin Luther King Jr. in the civil rights movement, live and in living color.
Oh, really?
In my own life.
Could you share some of that with our listening audience?
Yes. I was a senior at Morehouse College. Which is his alma mater.
Right.
I was a senior at Morehouse College when the Montgomery bus boycott began. Montgomery bus protests began. And I remember that in our local paper in Jacksonville, where I lived, there was an editorial on the moral validity of boycotts.
Ah, okay.
And I started a response to the writer, that editorial writer, but I never finished because immediately that summer I got a job as a mathematician at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, so I left Jacksonville. But you know, I was thinking about it, and then during those 3 years, I worked 3 years at Wright-Patterson until 1959, and in the process of that, I accepted my own call to ministry and entered seminary in 1959. And the various phases of the civil rights movement were going on. There were the sit-ins,
right,
that occurred when I was a seminary student. And I got related to that because we did, the choir traveled from Dayton through West Virginia and Virginia. We made a stop in Winchester, for example, and that was during the time of the sit-ins.
Oh, my.
And so there was a real tension on the part of the pastors who hosted our trip regarding my presence in the choir at the time and people's sensitivity about the sit-ins. So I happened to be primarily in seminary and then immediately in graduate school during the movement, but I was always involved by virtue of who I, you know, just by virtue of being and by virtue of the publicity regarding the movement.
Right.
And so when I went to Boston University, which was another, which was the school where King received his doctorate in 1962, and various things were going on, I was obviously conscious.
Yes.
And then studying social ethics, I was more than conscious. I was actually
immersed in that, yeah.
Thinking those things through. And both because of the local situation when we got involved in a controversy over de facto school segregation in Boston, and the national situation that was going on that we were continually in touch with, I was very aware of the civil rights movement broadly and of Martin Luther King Jr. in particular. And when I was completing my coursework, and the Pettus Bridge incident occurred in the Selma voting rights action, I suspended my sole commitment to graduate study and caught the bus with other fellow Boston students to go down to Selma to participate in the protest because I felt that what I had seen on the bridge was a challenge to any conscientious Christian and person committed to justice to get involved in what was going on.
Okay.
And yes.
Well, then, which leads me to ask you the question, what do you think, we know King's effect as a civil rights leader in terms of the transformation of this country,
yes,
our country, but what do you think was his effect on the life of the church?
Yes, his effect on the life of the church. It's very interesting. There was a segment of the church characterized primarily by younger, theologically trained for the most part, but educated clergy who were actively involved with the civil rights movement and who shared his relationship to the church and to civil rights. There was also a reactionary component where the leader of the National Baptist Convention, who saw Martin Luther King Jr. as a political rival for that leadership, who posed a counter understanding and opposed demonstrations as a way, so that it turns out that from the standpoint of action, although most black clergy shared the sentiment of protest,
right,
the clergy who were active in protests was a smaller number. It was really a minority of the clergy. Nevertheless, because of the action of Martin Luther King and those other clergy who were active, the black church had an image of being at the forefront,
right,
of the civil rights movement.
And I also see that King was able to cause some disequilibrium across denominations.
Yes.
Because there were various denominations who joined in, or individuals,
yes,
or leaders, yes, from these various denominations who joined in the movement.
Over the course of time, as the clergy leadership of the movement, particularly, and Martin Luther King as spokesperson, articulating very well and very clearly both the moral and the religious significance of the movement, and providing an avenue whereby persons' religious commitments could find expression through action to address matters of injustice, more and more people from a variety of denominations, and particularly whites from a variety of denominations, got involved in the movement. So by the time we get past Birmingham, up until Birmingham, the majority of the participants in the movement were black, were African Americans. But after Birmingham, and as we moved toward Selma, there got to be more and more involvement, primarily of Northerners, but some Southerners as well, a small group of Southern clergy. But there got to be more involvement of persons from a variety of denominations, Methodist, Catholic, Jewish rabbis, and...
Right, it was ecumenical in that sense.
It was ecumenical in that sense, so that by the time you get to Selma, they saw the same event that I did. That brought out a lot of people. And when you look at that march from Montgomery, I mean from Selma to Montgomery, when you see those Catholic nuns in their habits and those people wearing the clergy, you see those rabbis, and you see all of those people, and whereby the people who are participating in that march is almost, is 30 to 40% white.
Right.
You've mobilized and you've influenced the religious community at a profound level. And at that point, many religious leaders and academics began to look at the black church and at what was being expressed in the movement as a source of new theological and biblical understandings of faith that were relevant to the crisis of racial justice and other injustices at that time.
Okay. Well, I can't believe our time has run out.
Oh.
But we could go on for hours on this. But I think you helped to bring together the important elements of King's life for our listening audience. And I hope that you will return to Gettysburg and to continue talking and speaking and proclaiming the theological and ethical significance of Martin Luther King.
Well, thank you. I have certainly enjoyed being here, and I look forward to that. I look forward to that because students are responding and trying and finding ways that this has implications for their ministries today.
Okay, then. Well, for the Seminary Explorers, this is Nelson Strobert. My guest today has been Dr. Charles Brown, Distinguished Professor of Ethics at Payne Theological Seminary in Wilberforce, Ohio. For the Seminary Explorers, Nelson Strobert, saying, have a good day.
You've been listening to The Seminary Explores from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Gettysburg. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. All opinions expressed on this program are those of the individual speakers and are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.